Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, why it can be so hard to get life-saving treatment for people with addiction.
And jazz legend Branford Marsalis on finding his signature tone.
But first, the State House of Representatives could soon debate a bill that would allow development on property owned by churches, synagogues, mosques, and other religious institutions. The idea is called YIGBY, or Yes in God's Backyard. It's a play on the idea of NIMBY, or Not in My Backyard. The measure is one of several at the state capitol this year that aims to alleviate the housing shortage and increase the supply of affordable housing. This proposal has a requirement for at least 40% of the units to go to low-income residents for 55 years. Representative David Livingston, a Peoria Republican, is the measure sponsor.
The purpose of this bill, in my eyes, is to get the religious institutions more involved with the local community.
Among other provisions, the bill sets up requirements for religious institutions to be able to put single or multifamily housing on their property. They include that the institution has to have owned the site for at least 3 years and isn't within 75 feet of a neighboring site. There are also guidelines for height and other requirements of the developments. When the bill went through a House committee a couple of weeks ago, it won both bipartisan support and bipartisan opposition, as many housing bills do. Livingston says he's working on an amendment that he hopes brings skeptics on board.
I think there's a lot of people in this nation, in this state, that need help. I think religious institutions, as a general rule, can help those people better than government can.
Among those skeptics is Mary Crozier, president of the North Central Phoenix Homeowners Association. She stopped by the studio earlier to talk about the bill, and we started with what she thinks about it.
Well, I think before we even talk about that, we have to discuss how we got here, why affordable housing is now a hot topic in Arizona. And back in before the, around the pandemic, private equity firms and investors literally across the country went on a shopping spree. And this just didn't impact Arizona, but it impacted other states like Texas. And they literally purchased one out of every four single-family homes that were sold. So 25% of the market. As a result of that, housing prices went up 56% and rents went up 47% just by that one particular event. So couple that with that Arizona is one of the very few states that has stricter short-term vacation rental legislation that I just read in Scottsdale, 30% of the homes in Scottsdale are short-term vacation rentals. So when you couple those two together, and I'm sure there's some overlap with investors owning short-term vacation rentals,
sure.
You're talking about 45% of the market that no one has control over except for the investors and the people that have purchased those things. So my biggest concern about most of the housing bills that have been put forth is there's absolutely no provision to prevent that from happening again, and there's no provision that calls for affordable housing that has any teeth in it. So
in your mind then, is that the issue in terms of short-term rentals and making sure that non-investors own single-family homes, is that what the state needs to be doing before all this other stuff, all these other bills? The state should take those two issues up first in your mind?
Well, there's several issues that can take under consideration that in what I call our low-hanging fruit. For example, Arizona is one of six that does not allow inclusionary zoning. And that means if somebody were to build 100 apartments, that there would be a provision that a certain percentage of those would go to low or workforce housing.
Mm-hmm.
We don't allow that. So that's a state barrier. The second, obviously, is the short-term vacation rental. There's another tax, an incremental tax that, say, for example, we have a situation in our neighborhood where there was one lot, an out-of-state developer came in and wanted to rezone it to put 200 apartments on an acre or 2 acres, I think. And there's no fee the developer pays for how that will impact traffic, public services, infrastructure. That's all put on the shoulders of the taxpayer. So there are other things we could be doing right away that would immediately impact affordability. And the concept that if you build more, you create more density, oh, the prices will go down. Well, not in this market. We have, what, 200 to 300 people moving here a day, and it would take a very long time to reduce our housing prices just based on volume.
Would you agree, though, that there does need to be some more supply coming online, right? Like, we don't have enough housing units for the people who live here, and to your point, the people who are moving here. So given that, I'm assuming that is something you would agree with, at least to some extent. Are churches, synagogues, mosques, other religious institutions, like, is that a place that we should be looking at maybe putting some of this housing?
Well, I have 2 points to that. First of all, I think you had John Wade, who's a real estate assessor, who was on a week or two ago, and he said that home availability is up 40%, and these are homes that are 1 to 2,000 square feet. The problem is the prices haven't dropped, so there is housing availability right now, but again, is it affordable? My concern about churches, and I'll just give you our neighborhood as an example, is on one street from Missouri to Northern on Central Avenue, we have 8 church properties. Our entire neighborhood has about 100 acres of church property. So if you can put 200 units on 2 acres, which was recently passed on an adjacent street, so now picture, let's say half of the acreage turns into high-density apartments, so 50 times 200, what that would do to the community would be turn our streets into parking lots. Our infrastructure, we were platted in the late 1800s. We don't have new infrastructure. And to have a bill like this, yes, in God's backyard, where there's absolutely zero zoning oversight and residents not having ability to participate in the process, I think would be devastating.
Let me ask you about one of the things that you just mentioned about parking, because I believe that there is a provision in this bill that would require that the units that would be built on these religious grounds have at least one parking space per unit. Does that mitigate your concern at all that people wouldn't necessarily be parking on the street? There would probably be more traffic, but the people who live there would at least have a place to put a car.
Well, if you look at the church property at Bethany and Central, there's no parking on Bethany. There's no parking on Central.
That's a very big property.
Big property. So let's say you live in this unit, you and your partner, spouse, friend, whatever, and you have 2 cars and you got 1 parking place. One, where do you put the other car? Can't park it on the street. What if you have guests over? Where do they park? So that's why one size fits all does not work. This may work perfectly fine for a church somewhere else, but it wouldn't work fine for the churches in our neighborhood. It's just very loosely written. There are a lot of holes in this, and I think if it was a bill that was presented better and took into account different situations around the state, it might be more palatable. But this definitely wouldn't. And any bill that cuts out a local resident's ability to have a voice, there's a reason for that.
So let me ask you about that. And I want to know what about this bill maybe in your mind would make it more palatable. It sounds like giving residents the ability to have more of a say, maybe public hearings or something like that would be one of those. Are there other things that lawmakers could potentially look at that would make you say, okay, this could potentially work?
Possibly. But the writers of the bill have not reached out to neighborhood groups.
If they were to reach out, what would you tell them to do?
Well, we would certainly sit down and make sure what parts were not palatable. For example, on the height requirement, it can be as tall as the nearest building a quarter mile away. It could be as tall as 3 stories. It could be tall as the highest point on the church property. Well, what is that? Is that a steeple? The city of Phoenix doesn't have height requirements for a steeple. There's too many unknowns in this bill. As it stands, it's a definite no for us.
Interesting. All right. Mary, thanks for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark.
Mary Crozier is president of the North Central Phoenix Homeowners Association.
Back in 2018, the opioid crisis in Arizona was everywhere. Headlines were dominated by it. There was a special session at the Capitol to address it. Lawmakers unanimously passed the Arizona Opioid Epidemic Act, putting millions toward enforcement and treatment. But our next guest says some of the most effective treatments for opioid use disorder are too hard to get. Dr. Melody Glenn is an addiction and emergency physician in the Valley, as well as an assistant professor at the U of A's medical school here. And in a recent op-ed in the Arizona Republic, she argues that fentanyl is easier for many of her patients to get than the best treatment for it. I spoke with her more about it and why we don't talk about the opioid crisis so much anymore, even though it's still very much present.
You're absolutely right. Even though we're not talking about it, it's not because it's magically gone away. I think we've just sort of lost interest in it. We still have a huge overdose crisis in our country and in our state. In 2024, over 100,000 people died of a fatal overdose.
Wow. Okay. So still a massive problem. You treat patients with addiction, right? And who are addicted to these particularly incredibly addictive drugs like fentanyl, right? Talk
Yes.
a little bit about what this looks like for people, how difficult it can be to get out of it.
Yeah, lots of people who I see who use fentanyl and are addicted to it, they've come from a background with a lot of trauma in their lives, whether they've had family members who had addiction or were incarcerated or abuse in their family. Many of them are homeless at this time or have ongoing stressors and crises, and fentanyl helps them cope, helps them manage. Yeah. Sometimes they have physical pain as well. If they don't have physical pain, there's often some emotional or spiritual pain, and the fentanyl takes that away. So there's lots of root causes there that are very difficult to unravel and to treat, and it can take a long time to do so.
Yeah.
Luckily, there is a medication, two medications, buprenorphine and methadone, that really help people get off of illicit fentanyl, help them regain their lives, help them get stability. And then once they're doing better, they can work on some of those root causes.
Right. So these treatments that are now available were pretty groundbreaking when they were approved. Talk a little bit about how they work and how effective they can be.
If you see opioid use disorder like a chronic disease, which is how I see it and how most other physicians see it, these medications are much more effective than anything else we have. For example, we have this thing called the number needed to treat. So for any medication that people take, the number needed to treat tells us how many people have to receive this medication for one person to receive a clinical benefit. Mm-hmm. For things like aspirin, baby aspirin, which we tell people to take all the time for their heart disease, the number needed to treat is over 50. So out of every 50 people taking aspirin, only one will have a clinical benefit. In contrast, these medications for opioid use disorder, or MODE for short, have a number needed to treat of only two, and that's remarkable.
Wow.
So for every two people taking these meds, one sees benefit.
Okay, okay. But you say these are really hard to get. Like, as a physician with a patient who you know needs this kind of medication, you often can't get it. Tell us why.
There's lots of factors involved. One is stigma. There's a lot of stigma against these medications. There is a phrase that's often used in AA called a drug is a drug, and that's been internalized by lots of people, that they feel guilty getting on a medication to get off of fentanyl. They want to do it on their own. They want to do it without medications.
Sure. Yeah.
So there's stigma that people maybe don't want to take these meds, or their family members don't want them to take these medications. There are also regulatory challenges. Methadone is one of the most highly regulated medications in the country. For a clinic to offer methadone, they have to comply with a long list of federal requirements. It's very difficult to do. Mm. And so half of the country doesn't have access to a methadone clinic. I have lots of patients in rural Arizona who have to drive an hour a day to get methadone because they don't have one in their town.
Wow. Wow. So lots of challenges there. But you also say there are challenges in just getting it paid for.
Exactly. There are prior authorizations on these medications. Sometimes patients have to prove that they are going to have a failure without the meds, i.e. they have an overdose. If they survive that overdose, perhaps they can then get the prior authorization approved to get the life-saving medication. Sometimes the amount of the medication that they need is more than the average person, and so there's a prior authorization on certain amounts of medication that can be prescribed.
Sure.
And there's also prior authorizations on certain formulations of the medications.
So basically, this means that as a physician, it goes beyond writing a prescription. You have to make an argument that this patient needs this medication and this is why.
Exactly. Although prior authorizations are intended to save money for the insurance companies, they don't even always do that. Sometimes patients have worse health outcomes that then lead to increased hospitalizations, which end up costing the system even more money.
So these prior authorizations are supposed to, right, like you said, control outrageous costs in healthcare, make sure that providers aren't overlooking cheaper alternatives that work just as well. Have you seen them be successful in doing that before?
No. The AMA does an annual survey, too.
The American Medical Association, yeah.
Yes, and it talks to physicians about their experience with prior authorizations, and it's overwhelmingly negative.
So there have been efforts at the state legislature here, and many other states, I think almost a dozen, have passed legislation that would address this, that would get rid of these requirements for these particular medications. What would that do?
I think this would make a huge difference, especially in my practice. So a bunch of my practice is at the hospital level in the emergency department and an addiction consult service where we see patients who have been admitted for other things, whether traumatic injuries, burns, infections, and we see them if they have a substance use issue, start these medications. But some of these medications we can't start in the hospital because we can't do the prior authorization in time. For my patients in the emergency department, I can't do a prior authorization form because it takes 7 to 14 days to get back. And I'm just seeing someone in the emergency department who I'm discharging in a couple of hours. Same with the consult service. Patients might be discharged later that day or the next. Not enough time to get this prior authorization. So I don't have access to a lot of medications that I would love to offer my patients, so I think we'd do much better on them.
What do you do instead? So, like you see someone in the emergency room who, you can diagnose in this way, who you say they would really benefit from these medications. I can't get them for them fast enough. They're only here for this amount of time. What do you prescribe instead? How do you treat them?
So I can start methadone, I can start Suboxone, and that goes underneath their tongue and it dissolves. I can start those in the emergency department. I can also send a prescription for regular Suboxone. But not all of my patients can pick up that prescription. They can't pay for it at time of discharge. Even if they can, sometimes it gets stolen. Lots of my patients don't have homes, they don't have stable living environments. They would really benefit from a monthly injectable form instead. And then I usually get a call. Someone calls the consult service, lets me know my patient's back. They weren't able to get their medication. They relapsed onto fentanyl. Their heart failure got worse, and now they're back in the hospital.
It sounds like something of a vicious cycle.
It definitely is. And it's extremely frustrating. I feel like I spend so much of my time trying to work on these systemic barriers. That's why I wrote the op-ed. That's why I'm trying to get more involved in advocacy, because otherwise, the same things keep coming up again and again and again for my patients, and I can't fix them otherwise.
All right, we'll leave it there. That is Dr. Melody Glenn, an addiction and emergency physician here in Arizona, as well as assistant professor at the University of Arizona's Med School, joining us to talk more about this. Dr. Glenn, thank you so much for coming on. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, a coming-of-age memoir that tackles the friction between American culture and Native inheritance. We'll hear from the author of Whiskey Tender.
But first, as musical dynasties go, it's tough to top the Marsalis family. Patriarch Ellis Marsalis played with Cannonball Adderley and taught students like Terrence Blanchard and Harry Connick Jr. Four of Ellis's sons became jazz musicians as well, including Pulitzer Prize winner Wynton Marsalis and Grammy winner Branford Marsalis. Branford, a saxophonist, is currently on tour, and he'll be performing at the Scottsdale Center for Performing Arts tomorrow night. The show's Sam Dingman recently caught up with Branford between gigs. Marsalis was running late, and he had to duck into an IHOP to take the call.
Okay, I might have to mute you when the waitress comes over here. But other than that, I'm ready to go.
Okay, sounds good. What are you planning to order?
I have no idea. A Coca-Cola? I'm not even hungry. So don't worry about that.
Okay.
It's just one of these things. I got caught out here and I went, oh boy.
We'll use the IHOP as a field, a remote recording studio.
There you go.
Well, let
Live
me.
And authentic.
Yes, excellent. Brentford, I wanted to ask to start. You're from New Orleans, and I was wondering, how do you feel like the New Orleans context informs your point of view on jazz specifically?
It informs my view on everything. New Orleans is the greatest music city in our country. I grew up playing clarinet in a kid's traditional jazz band that was led by Danny Barker, who was the banjoist with Louis Armstrong for 20 years.
Wow.
And then I played in an R&B band, played in a church band. I played in a brass band. I was able to do all these things that in the 1970s, you just assumed everybody had those things because we didn't have mobile phones and we certainly didn't have the internet. So I had no idea what was happening in New York or Boston. So when I did finally leave, I was kind of shocked.
Oh, that's interesting. That's interesting. So because you came from a place where the musical boundaries were more permeable, you just sort of thought of that as like the primary language of the music.
Primary language of everything.
Yeah.
You know, I thought everybody had red beans and rice, and everybody had crawfish, and everybody had gumbo.
Yeah.
Everybody said, how's your mom and them? Everybody said, where you at? What's happening? You know, so I had to learn like a different way of speaking, a different way of communicating to people. The music scenes on the East Coast in New York were kind of highly specialized.
Yes.
You decided you wanted to do a thing, and then you became that thing. So much so that when I was in New York, I went to hear David Sanborn play because he was a big hero of mine in my teenage years. And Hiram Bullock, who was a great guitar player, was a guitarist at the time, said, hey, man, what are you doing here? You're a jazz guy. In New Orleans, no one would ever say that. In New Orleans, they'd be like, hey, bro, what's happening? How's your daddy doing? Come on in. So where I hear the beat is very different than where other people hear the beat.
Yeah,
I have more in common with a lot of church guys as to where the beat should be. Even though I was I'm a Catholic and I didn't really grow up in the Protestant churches, but the Protestant churches, I used to go there for my musical experiences because they were swinging. Jazz comes from the Pentecostal church beat in the South. The 1-2-3-4 with the accent on 2 and 4, that was in the church first. So you have all of these sounds swirling around. And nobody's differentiating. I mean, the church's position that was jazz was the devil's music and you shouldn't play it. But then the deacon would be in the bar checking it out.
Yeah.
With a drink in his hand. You know? So there's this duality to it.
There's a lot of people, I think, who, you know, especially when they're newcomers to jazz, they find it to be a little unapproachable or a little esoteric and kind of scholarly as a form of music, which is obviously at odds with the version of it that you're talking about, which is much more this spirit of instant inclusivity. Like you kind of get in where you fit in and it comes from a much more kind of rooted place, if I'm hearing you correctly.
When you say jazz to musicians now, the next word out of their mouth is improvisation. But their approach to it is harmony. It's a harmonic approach, not a melodic approach. When you listen to the old guys, you could hear elements of the melody in their solo. They were playing a solo based on the melody, not based on the chord structure. We live in this era, and it's been an era, it's decades of this in jazz. The musicians that play it didn't really grow up with a populist bent.
Right.
They didn't march in the marching band. They went to jazz camp. They're really, really, really smart people. But then there's a social aspect to music. The technical execution is the thing you do to impress your comrades.
Right.
Because the people don't care about that.
Right.
They have to feel something.
You're making me think, Branford. I mean, I fell in love with jazz, I have to admit, partially when I was in high school as a way of kind of, it differentiated me from my peers a little bit. It was not populist. It was a little bit esoteric. And right. I hadn't thought about that until having this conversation with you that, especially coming out of a New Orleans context where this is the music that is part of what is just filling the streets. It's just like the air that you breathe. That's a very different way in to jazz than thinking of it as this kind of, I don't know, almost mystical form that few people understand or ever breathe in.
The metaphor I use is I'm a really big baseball fan, but the Mets don't require me to feel 200 grounders before I give them my money to go in the stadium. 1 second, please.
Yep.
Okay. Back. Sorry about that.
No worries. Did you get the Coca-Cola?
No, they don't have Coke products, but I got a Dr. Pepper.
Okay.
Yay.
Good. So, good. The doctor is in.
Yes. Well, yeah, some kind of doctor. People are attracted to sound. People are not attracted to information. The problem isn't what you're playing. The problem is how you deliver it.
Yeah.
I was working in a nightclub when I was a kid. The club owner, I sat down with him because he was a friend of my dad's. And he's like, look, man, the reason we like the music loud is that when the music's loud, people have to talk over it. When people talk over it, they get thirsty, they buy drinks. The reason we want it to be funky is that if it's funky, some people will get up and dance. And when they dance, they sweat and then they'll buy drinks. The whole thing is about buying drinks. It's not about you. You help me sell drinks.
Right, right.
So that's a lesson I learned when I was 15 years old.
Right. I mean, this is sort of a piece with what you were talking about jazz in New Orleans being also informed by other styles of music and food and stuff. There's this idea that the music is part of something bigger. It's not just about you.
And with the modern jazz musician, I know for a fact, that is not an aesthetic that they appreciate.
Hmm. Why do you think that is?
No one, I don't know why. They're from a different place to me. I think that there are a lot of musicians who know more music than they can hear. Everyone plays to their strengths.
Mm-hmm.
What I've always tried to do is like rush headlong into my weaknesses and eliminate them.
What are some of the weaknesses you feel like you've had to eliminate?
Oh my God. My tone was terrible.
Huh.
Art Blakey yelled on the bandstand once, you know, get a real sound.
Huh.
And then when I backed away from the mic, he started playing louder, saying, I can't hear you. And I'm like, okay, man, message received. So I started working on my tone.
So when you were looking for your own tone, how did you know when you had found it? Was it something that you felt like in your body coming through the horn, or was it something that somebody like Blakey reflected back to you at a certain point?
No, I went to Blakey and said, you know, what should I do? He said, listen to people who have big sound. Mm-hmm. And I said, okay, great. So my three guys were Glenn Webster, Sonny Rollins, and Coleman Hawkins.
Mm-hmm.
And people say, well, man, you're trying to play like them? I said, no, I'm trying to sound like them.
Yeah.
And you work on it and work on it and work on it. You listen, you listen, you listen. You listen for 2 years, no change. 3 years, no change. 4 years, no change. And then you give up on it, and 2 years later, it shows up.
Well, Brentford Marsalis is a saxophonist, a composer, a band leader, and an educator. And he will be performing at Scottsdale Center for the Performing Arts on March 5th. Brentford, thank you so much for this conversation.
Thanks.
Good morning. It is the show here on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Researchers have gotten a good and unique look at the country's groundwater system, and it shows that system is more interconnected than scientists previously thought. Laura Condon is an associate professor in the Department of Hydrology and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Arizona, where she builds large models of hydraulic systems. She worked on this research along with scientists at Princeton. She joins me to talk more about it. And Laura, is it fair to say there were some things that you found that were surprising too?
Yeah, so it's really well known that groundwater and surface water are connected, and we know that subsurface flow paths are really important. But they are very difficult to observe just because of the cost of drilling wells and taking measurements. And so what was really cool about this work is that we could build this model of the entire country and see how things were happening across scale. So not just across a single watershed, but across watersheds. And so it was really, I think, surprising just to see the extent of the connections and how many really long flow paths exist in our groundwater system.
Yeah, let's pardon the pun, drill down on that a little bit, because I'm curious, like, so does this basically mean that water from different parts of the country, groundwater from different parts of the country, is maybe more interconnected than we thought it was?
Yeah, for sure it does. I mean, you know, we're not talking about groundwater going like from coast to coast. There are still barriers to this at the very large watershed level and based on, you know, geology and mountain ranges and stuff like that. But it means that within our kind of smaller subbasins and things like that, that water is routinely crossing what we often think of as watershed and subwatershed boundaries. So, you know, specifically we're showed that there's really common to have groundwater flow paths that are longer than 50 kilometers. And even longer than 100 kilometers is not, you know, unheard of.
What are the implications of that?
I think the big implication of it is just to show that our systems are more connected than we think, and that when we try to do things like do water balances on small basins and think about the ins and the outs, that there's likely a lot of water that's crossing through the subsurface that is not obeying those boundaries, and that can kind of mess up how we think about our accounting in watersheds if we're not careful.
Well, so I'm wondering if, like, what that might mean, for example, for some places in Arizona where, you know, groundwater pumping has been happening at faster rates than that water is being replenished. Might this have an implication for those particular areas, either on the positive or the negative?
Yeah. So, I mean, in places like Arizona and the Western U.S. in general, we already have deeper groundwater systems. And so one thing that's actually just cool is just looking across the US from the east to the west at how those groundwater systems look different. And because we already have this huge history of groundwater development, we've already disconnected a lot of our groundwater systems, and we have deeper and longer flow paths already. And so what that means is that our systems are slower to respond, and that we have a lot less connections between groundwater and surface water than we used to.
When you say slower to respond, does that also mean slower to recharge?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, recharge is, I mean, that's a complicated topic, but recharge is really depending on the intensity of rainfall we get, not just how much rainfall we get. And in a lot of places, like Arizona, depending on where you are, we have very, very little natural recharge that's occurring.
I'm also curious what this might mean for issues and maybe concerns about pollution from one place to another if groundwater systems are more interconnected than we maybe thought they were. Is it possible that, you know, problems in one area might, you know, wind their way into another area without people necessarily thinking about that?
Yeah, absolutely. This is something we worry about a lot when we think about groundwater contamination, is how far can it spread and where all can it go? And we really show that there's a lot of connections happening over long distances. And what's critical about what we're showing is that these are connections, we traced these back from surface water bodies. So this is groundwater actually making its way back to surface water. And so you can think about groundwater contamination, not just spreading underground, but groundwater contamination also making it back to surface water bodies.
How do you see this research fitting into conversations, both, you know, maybe at the state level and also the national level, about dealing with an overextended Colorado River and, you know, dwindling groundwater supplies and just general water scarcity? Like, how does this research and what you found fit into those conversations?
Well, I think in general, we just really want to raise awareness about the importance of groundwater and the fact that you can't just view watersheds from the surface. You can't just think of it, here's the snowpack, here's the water in the river, and we're good. Actually, 99% of our unfrozen freshwater is underground. Groundwater is huge. And even if we're really concerned about what's, say, the stream flow in the Colorado River, the important thing to know is that a lot of that stream flow has spent some of its journey underground. Snow melts and can infiltrate and then reappear in the river. So if you want to understand our rivers and how they work, you have to understand how they're connected to groundwater. And this becomes increasingly important as we look to the future and think about groundwater levels that could be changing, because that can change how much groundwater actually makes it to the stream.
Yeah. So now that you have this data, what would you like to do next? Like, what's the next thing you'd either like to try to figure out or maybe use this information to answer the next question?
Yeah, so we're really excited about the models that we've been able to build, this really large scale national model that we're able to do this particle tracking on that supported this work. Moving forward, we have a lot of exciting opportunities to start to do more transient scenarios of like, okay, what would this look like in the future if this changed, if things got warmer, if we changed the snowpack, if we change, you know, land cover, like with large scale wildfires. And to see how those kinds of changes might reshape the flow paths in our watersheds. What we have right now, what we presented in this research, is kind of like this background natural, this is what the flow paths are in general. But there's a lot of questions about how these can evolve and change in the future and over what timescales it'll happen. And that has big implications for our surface water system. So that's what I'm really excited about going forward.
All right. That is Laura Condon, Associate Professor in the Department of Hydrology and Atmospheric Sciences at the University of Arizona. Laura, thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
5 years ago, one of the most popular podcasts of the time called it quits. The Longest Shortest Time was around for nearly a decade before its host and creator, Hillary Frank, put it on hold in 2020. But now it's back. It was one of the first self-sustaining podcasts exploring what Frank calls the surprises and absurdities of raising other humans and being raised by them. And now, Frank told me, the landscape around reproductive health has changed, along with conversations about consent and bodily autonomy, and she felt the pull to come back. You'll even hear her now teenage daughter in one episode. Here's our conversation.
So before I did the longest, shortest time, I was kind of on the teen beat. I wrote young adult novels, and most of the stories I did for the radio were about teenagers. Mm. When I started the longest, shortest time, making a living as a podcaster was not a thing. And so I had started it about a year after having a baby, just sort of like as a way to keep my foot in the door, let people know that like I could still work, you know, because I hadn't been making stories in a little while. And it was kind of my calling card. And then like miraculously it grew and became my job, but I never really intended to be a parenting reporter. I don't know. It wasn't what I had really wanted to do. It was more like I liked telling stories, and my heart kind of always was like with the teenagers still. And I also like, it really is a lot. It's a grind to be putting out a weekly show. And yeah. I just reached a point where I was like, I need a break from this. And I made a fiction show called Here Lies Me about middle school. And I worked with real teenagers, real young actors to make the show. And it was really fun.
Yeah. So a change of pace and sort of going back to your roots a little bit, it sounds like.
Yeah.
So talk about the decision to bring this back now. Like when you started Longest, Shortest Time, you had just had a baby in this kind of traumatic way, we should say. And like that was a lot of your motivation for starting this podcast. You wanted to talk about these things that no one was talking about at the time. Mm-hmm. Now that baby is a teenager, right? Like this is all coming full circle for you.
She's 15.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So the show, I put it on hiatus 5 years ago, mm-hmm. right? So that was right before the pandemic. That was before Roe fell. Just so much has changed with how we think about reproductive health and consent, sex ed, bodily autonomy, the ways that babies are made. All of this stuff is so in flux now and so different from how we were thinking about it 5 years ago. And it just felt to me like there are new stories to be told that I would like to tell. And I also think there's so much about raising a teenager and being a person who is like going through perimenopause now, whatever that is. I still don't entirely know, but I intend to find out.
Right.
It's just like so ripe for discussion. So I just felt like I felt a pull back in.
Yeah. Well, and so, like you said, your daughter is now a teenager, and teens, it sounds like, will be central to this kind of new incarnation of Longest, Shortest Time, right?
That is right. So I am going to be talking to teenagers and about teenagers. But in addition to the regular show, I also have a premium feed for the show, LST Plus. And in that feed, something extra that people get is a special show that I'm calling You Know What. Mm. And it's because it's about everything having to do with You Know What. And so it features three really fun, smart, thoughtful college kids. And we take questions from the audience. So it's kind of an Ask the College Kids show about sex, dating, and relationships.
Wow. Okay. So a unique approach to that as well. It sounds like the conversation around parenting has changed, especially, you know, there's a lot more of this, I think, just around raising little kids, having babies. There's a lot more truth telling in that realm, which I think you should credit yourself with starting that conversation in many ways.
Oh, thank you.
But do you feel like that's what you're trying to do here with teenagers, like talking about those things that are still not talked about in the same way?
Yeah. And I think it's even like worse than that. It's like not even that we're not talking about it, but those conversations are being suppressed now. And I live in a district where it's pretty diverse. It's pretty liberal. And it's not like the school system doesn't want sex ed to be taught. There is a mandate. I live in New Jersey. There's a state mandate to teach sex ed, and there are a few subjects that are required. One of them is consent. I discovered when my kid was entering eighth grade that she and her classmates had gotten zero sex ed, wow. Just nothing. And, you know, it's not because the school system didn't want to be doing it. It's because it turns out this stuff is just kind of left in the hands of gym teachers to decide how and if they're going to teach it. And in a lot of cases, I think they feel they don't feel prepared to do it. They feel awkward about it. And so some of them skip it. And so I think a lot of schools are doing a bad job or no job at all of teaching kids about this stuff. And in the meantime, people are losing rights. And we just like, we need kids to know how people get pregnant, you know? We need them to know, like, know the connection between sex and pregnancy and the menstrual cycle. These are like basics that people need to know before they start engaging in sexual activity. You know, nobody wants a pregnant eighth grader, and nobody especially wants like a pregnant eighth grader where there's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah, that's so interesting. It's just not happening. So you're trying to create it, but it's happening, like you're creating that conversation in a world in which I think being a teenager probably looks very different than it did for you or I, or it did for teenagers 10 years ago. I wonder how you think like the current culture, current technology, current political landscape plays into this.
Yeah, well, there's so much. I mean, porn wasn't readily available when we were younger, and it looked a lot different than it does now. Kids are able to just access all kinds of stuff immediately through their phones. And then at the same time, you have like healthy education about sex and consent being suppressed by powerful figures. And so these two things in combination, I feel like, are a really dangerous cocktail for young people.
All right. We will leave it there for now. That is Hillary Frank, the podcast host of The Longest Shortest Time, which is back. Hillary, thank you so much for coming back on. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. In her new memoir, Whiskey Tender, writer Deborah Jackson Toffa tells the story of her family's transition from life on a Native American reservation in Yuma to a volatile border town in New Mexico. Along the way, she blends her own history with the painful realities of racism, police violence, and forced assimilation that have plagued generations of Native families. As Toffa prepared to write the book, which took her 20 years to finish, she knew it would be important to illustrate the narrative with pivotal scenes from her youth. And when she spoke with the show's Sam Dingman about it, she told him the very first memory that came to mind when she started writing.
The one that came to shape, I think, though, quickly and was the thing that I first saw in the book was my Uncle Johnny's funeral. I was old enough at that point that I remembered much of it, the bird singers, the richness of the traditional experience, kind of in contrast to what had become by that point a mainstream life for me because I was attending a Catholic school. The aboutness, though, of a chapter is always elusive, like figuring out beyond the anecdote, what is the deeper meaning in this? That was harder to come by.
Yeah. Well, you have a teacher at that time, if I'm not mistaken, who kind of talks to your class about what it means to engage with death, and the teacher's version of what that is ends up standing in really stark contrast to your experience, and it becomes a way for you of realizing this way that you're stuck between all these worlds.
Yes, Sam, that is a very good read. I mean, I think the thing that comes into relief in that chapter is the poverty of the rituals that are a part of post-industrial society, like the coming of age ritual of getting a driver's license replaces these profound indigenous coming of age rituals that I would have had if my ancestors had maintained their culture. And death is one of these things that becomes very watered down. And the beauty of indigenous rituals and the beauty of the cremation ceremony to me made such a big impact. It was probably the moment in my life where I knew I was facing a choice, whether or not I would find meaning in my life via American culture, or whether I was going to bend towards an appreciation for my indigenous traditions.
Yeah.
And I hope it came through in the chapter. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, one of the things I really appreciated about that moment in the story is that there's actually a lot of nuance in terms of the cultural clash that's happening there, because the nun slash teacher that you have at that time is sort of appalled to discover that a lot of the kids in your class have never been to a funeral before. And she tells a very personal story about the death of her sister, but she tells it from the standpoint of death is something you should be exposed to so that you can just get over the fact that it's going to bring up big feelings and put those feelings away. And then you tell your story of going to a funeral where, in a way, it's a similar ethos. It's not hiding death from young people. You're there for it.
Right.
But it's very much about experiencing the feeling. It's very much about the momentousness of the emotion.
It is. There are designated criers, and it's a way for you to purge the pain, and these sort of the confrontation of death becomes something that is expressed so that that illness and that grief can leave your body rather than kind of balling it up inside and carrying it away around in a way that's unhealthy. And the interesting thing about the nun in that year when I was in school was how wounded she still felt, because she felt complicit in her little sister's death.
But you're also hitting on something else that comes up, not to dwell too much on it, but also comes up in this particular chapter that I am keen to ask you about, which is another thing that happens when you get to this Catholic school is that you get recognized for your storytelling abilities. You give a recitation in front of the class, and I think it's a different teacher pulls you aside and says, you were excellent at that, and I'd like to have you get up in front of the entire school and do this recitation of Paul Revere's Ride, which is obviously a very patriotic American story. So it's this interesting moment where you're being recognized as somebody with the capacity to tell stories in an impactful way, but the opportunity that you're given is to tell this story that has nothing to do with your own community's history and culture.
Right. It was the version of American history that is told and kind of excludes the country's origin story and the contributions of my ancestors.
One of the other elements of that in my mind is how perceptive you were as a child. I'm thinking in particular about, there's a moment where you walk in and your dad is listening to a Richard Pryor record. And even though you're too young to understand the references that Richard Pryor is making, there's something about the way that he's reacting to the jokes on the record that you just kind of have this instinctive understanding that there's more happening than what you are maybe processing in a literal way.
As a child, the adults around me, they had such strong emotions. Everything was heightened. You know, when you come from a community that is struggling, you don't have sort of a daily status quo where things are rote and habitual. You have a lot of mood swings, and the energy that comes off of parents and relatives and neighbors, the painful aspects of their existence, it's hard to miss as a child. And so you develop a way of being on your toes because you're never sure what's going to happen next. In a community that suffers from pain and violence, it's actually crucial to your survival.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that before, but that makes so much sense. I mean, there's just so much dynamic energy in the air all the time in an unstable household, that if you have your antenna up, it's just like there's constantly an invitation for you to try to make sense of it somehow.
That's exactly it. You put it very well. Yeah. And again, I think it's also tribal values very much speak to my desire to serve my community. And throughout my life, it's been really difficult to juggle those two oppositional value systems, how to pursue the American dream in a way that felt ethical as an Indigenous person. I hope that's what the book ultimately portrays, is the very difficult questions that we as Indigenous people face to make our peace with being American citizens.
Well, Deborah Jackson Taffa is the author of Whiskey Tender and is also the director of the Master of Fine Arts Creative Writing Program at the Institute of American Indian Arts. Deborah, thank you so much for this conversation.
It was a pleasure to speak with you, Sam.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.